Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Tanya Mosley. Reservation Dogs, the critically acclaimed hit TV series set on an Indian reservation in Oklahoma, has returned for a third season. We're going to listen to an interview Terry recorded last year before the writers and actors strike with Sterling Harjo, the co-creator and writer and director on the series. He co-created the show with New Zealand filmmaker Taika Waititi. The series is part comedy and part drama about teenagers wanting to break away from the reservation while also finding reasons to stay. The characters face generational differences on the reservation and the confusion of growing up caught between traditional culture and pop culture, as well as the spirit world and rap music. The series shows the importance of Native traditions while also mocking how tradition can be turned into sanctimonious pop culture cliches. Harjo is Native American and has made independent films and documentaries about Native Americans in Oklahoma, where he grew up and continues to live. Reservation Dogs is the first and only TV series where every writer, director, and series regular is Indigenous. Season 3 of the FX show is now streaming on Hulu. When Terry spoke with Harjo last year, they began with a scene from the first season. One of the teenagers, named Bear, has been planning to leave the reservation with his friends and start a new life in California. He's been knocked down after being hit with paintballs by a rival group of teens. And when he opens his eyes, he sees an Indian warrior from the spirit world, mounted on a horse and dressed in the kind of traditional warrior clothes you'd expect to see in a Western. It's a funny scene, but the advice the spirit gives at the end is pretty good advice. Bear is played by Defaro Wunatai, and the spirit is played by Dallas Goldtooth.
Aho! Young warrior! Looks as though you've tasted the white man's lead.
It's only paintballs.
I've had many brothers and sisters meet the same fate in my time.
Are you Crazy Horse or sitting...
No. I'm not one of those awesome guys, no. I'm more of your unknown warrior. Yeah. You know my name? William Knife Man. I was at the Battle of Little Bighorn. That's right. I didn't kill anybody, but I fought bravely. Well, I didn't actually fight. I actually didn't even get into the fight itself. But I came over that hill real rugged like. I saw Custer like that. That yellow hair. He was sitting there. Son of the Morning Star. That guy right there. I really hated him. So I went after him. But then the damn horse hit a gopher hole, rolled over and squashed me. I died there. This horse, actually. And now I'm meant to travel the spirit world, find lost souls like you. The spirit world, it's cold. My nipples are always hard. I'm always hungry.
Got it.
Being a warrior, it's not always easy. You and your thuggy-ass friends, what are you doing for your people? It's easy to be bad, but it's hard to be a warrior with dignity. Remember that. In my time, we gave everything. We died for our people. We died for our land. What are you gonna do? What are you gonna fight for? I just f***ing with you. But for real though, listen to what I said. Marinate on that. Oh.
I love that scene so much, and I love the series. Sterling Harjo, welcome to Fresh Air, and thank you for Reservation Dogs. Can you talk a little bit about coming up with a way to both satirize pop culture images of Indians and also just come up with really comedic Indian characters, but also to create a sense of understanding of the importance of traditions? It's a lot to do all at once.
Yeah, real quick, Terry. So I'm a big fan. I remember being in college, driving around listening to your show. And I was like, I was attempting to write a film, I believe. And I remember thinking to myself, I'll know I made it when I get on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. So thanks for making my dreams come true today.
Thank you so much for that. You made my day.
Yeah. I think that character in that scene is crucial. And, I think, you know, most of the time people are very precious with Native people and like, you know, you don't, this is no laughing matter. And, you know, this is very serious and stoic. And that's kind of how, you know, the world is trained to view us. And we realize like we need to bake in this show, like permission to laugh with us. And I think that that spirit character, he comes in at this moment in the pilot. And it's like, if I ask most people in the world, draw a Native American, that's what they would draw. They would draw an Indian that was dressed in buckskins from the 1800s. They wouldn't draw me. They wouldn't draw any of the characters on the show. So it was almost like giving people some familiar territory and then turning it on its head. And it allows the audience to say, okay, isn't this funny? Like, we still think that Native people are like this. And yeah, in history, you know, some of us were like that. But isn't it ridiculous that we still think that they are? And so it gives people permission to laugh. I think it sort of welcomes them into Native humor and allows you to kind of get your footing as you watch the rest of the show.
Well, we're on the subject of permission.
Yeah.
I had asked you before we started, like, what word you like to use? Do you like to use Indian, Native American, Indigenous? And the term that you don't want to use is Native American. But some people say that, you know, as a white person, like, white people shouldn't use the word Indian. So before everybody kind of gets annoyed with me, or I get annoyed with myself, or you get annoyed right. with me, just right. help me out here. Like, what works?
For me, I mean, look, I grew up, my grandma said Indian. So I'm not here to change what my grandma said. And it's what I know. I'm sorry that Christopher Columbus got it wrong, but that's what we call ourselves, you know? I also say Native and I say Indigenous. Just depending on where I'm at and who I'm talking to, those are all interchangeable to me.
So,
and Native American is just a mouthful, you know. I don't have to sit around. It's just you know, it wastes time.
All right. So the series is called Reservation Dogs, an homage to Reservoir Dogs, Quentin Tarantino's film. What did that film mean to you, and the sensibility that he created in it, which was really something new?
So it came out when I was in college, and it was right as I discovered that I could be a filmmaker. You know, there's something about Tarantino's love for cinema. It's like, that's the same thing as growing up as a Native kid in rural Oklahoma. My father had a friend who worked for the cable company, and that's the only way that we got cable. So I was able to watch movies for free because his friend hooked us up with a cable box that allowed us to watch HBO and Showtime. So I was became immersed in movies and pop culture. MTV was out at the time. And I don't know, like, I think that when you're from a rural community, you know, that's kind of how you live your life. You almost like live your life through movies and through pop culture. And it just felt like the right, I mean, first of all, it's a catchy title, I'm not going to lie, but Dyke and I came up with
Absolutely.
That. But like,
yeah.
And then it was, well, if we're going to have this show where these kids are living through and constantly referencing pop culture, like, we have to tip our hat to the master of that.
When you were growing up, were you growing up like on the reservation or near the reservation?
Yeah, well, right now I live on the Muscogee Reservation, which is part of Tulsa. Through a lot of complicated government policy and interactions with tribal governments that I can't go into because it'd be another show, it was not identified as a reservation before, but it is now. But if you look at Oklahoma, it used to be Indian Territory, which was essentially one big reservation. It was, you know, and then of course oil and the land run and other things disrupted that. But this is where Trail of Tears ended. This is where all of the tribes that were forcibly removed by the U.S. government, we were brought to Indian Territory, which is Oklahoma. And I think there's something like 38 tribes here. So you grow up different when you're in Oklahoma as a Native kid, you know, like, I didn't feel different actually. Like people know Native culture, people know who Native people are. And it's a very diverse state. I mean, I think that not a lot of people know about Oklahoma and the diversity here. And I don't know, it was something that I wanted to celebrate in this show, you know, growing up in Indian Territory, Oklahoma.
You know, in talking about the influence of pop culture on the characters, on the young characters in your show, and some of the older characters too, the younger characters are so influenced by Black pop culture, by rap, their style of speaking. I found that very interesting. And I'm wondering if there were many Black people where you were growing up.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it was, you know, mainly made up of white, Native, and Black people. And all of those cultures mix and collide and, you know, come together. You know, the people in the show, they're not acting those accents. You know, that's where they come from, and that's how they talk. And, you know, as far as, like, rap being an influence on the culture, I don't know. I think, like, coming of age as rap was, you know, reaching the height of popularity in rural Oklahoma and being a Native kid, we gravitated towards it. It gave Native kids a culture and an identity that they could grab a hold of at a time where our own identity was a bit lost and our own identity was less celebrated. We could grab a hold of hip hop, and that became something that we could identify with.
So in this series, you know, dead loved ones return as ghosts. What are your experiences with keeping up a relationship with, you know, family, friends who have died and you want to keep in your life? Were you brought up with the idea that they are still spirits or ghosts?
You know, I think that part of growing up in with Muscogee and Seminole culture is death is such a part of our experience. You know, it's very community driven. You know, your cousins are like your brothers and sisters, your aunts are your extended parents. And, you know, you're close to your elders and everyone's, you know, a part of this tight community. And I was constantly at funerals. Someone was always passing away. And that is the big mystery and the big confusion, I think, for most people. It's like, wow, like, they're gone, you know? But I just grew up with this sense of magic, and there's a sense of, like, we can communicate, we can reach people in other places, and there's ceremonies for it, and there's different things. But I don't know, it's something that I'm fascinated with, and I explore it as much as I can through my work. I mean, all of my films deal with death in some way. And if you look at season two, I mean, there's an episode that aired called Mabel that is about the character Laura Dannon's grandmother passing away. And it's a whole episode about her dying. And I wrote it with the actress who plays Laura Dannon, Devery Jacobs. And it's based on my grandma passing away. And like the whole community came together. We were all there. The family was there every night. We were with her. And people would come in and sing songs, and funny things were happening outside, and sad things, and all everything. Life was happening in this one house, and that's what I try to show in this episode.
In the episode where Alora's grandmother is dying, and the grandmother raised Alora after Alora's mother died, Alora asks one of the characters, a boy named Cheese who's 15 years old, and who's part of this group of friends, she asks him to say a prayer, a blessing, before the meal. And I want to play that scene. So we'll hear Devery Jacobs as Alora, and Cheese is played by Lane Factor.
Hey, everybody. I think we should say a prayer before we eat. Cheese, did you want to say the blessing?
Yeah, I'll say it. Would everyone please stand? Bow your heads. Saying a prayer. The Lord, the Creator, he, she, they, whatever your pronouns may be, we ask you to bless this food and the people that cooked it. We know our friend Alora here is having a hard time right now, as her grandma transcends into that place in the great beyond. Amen. In a galaxy far, far away. In our grief, we come to you. In your name, amen.
Meadow. Meadow. Okay, everybody. Humbucks. Humbucks.
It's a scene from Reservation Dogs. I love the way, like, you know, Star Wars, or no, it's not Star Wars, it's Star Trek, kind of like seamlessly blends into this prayer. It's all like one thing to this 15-year-old. Right. They're all part of his belief system. And I love this character of 15-year-old Cheese. And just as he said, Lord, you know, he, she, they, whatever pronouns they use, when he introduces himself to people, it's always, and I use the pronouns, he, him, right, his. Right. And like, right, when he says that to people, they mostly have no idea what he's talking about. And I just think that's, you know, it's just really, really funny. Can you talk to me a little bit about that, about having him say that and why you did that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like, you know, it's an endearing quality. It's like, I think that there's such a debate over, do we say this or don't we in this country and world? And here you have this really kind human who says, you know, just to make things smooth and easy, it's kind of showing you how easy it is, you know, if you want to. And I just think that he kind of represents some of the younger generation of us, you know, like he, it's not a big deal to him. It's not a political issue for him. He's just considerate. He's also very well read and very educated, you know, kind of stays up with pop culture, but also like loves old movies, has like all of the old, you know, references and movies and things like that. He reminds me of people that I know, but I mean, you know, just to say something about Lane Factor, he never acted before.
And he's so good, and I love his voice.
Right, he's great, and he you know, he never had acted, and he'd been playing too much video games, and his mom had made him take an acting class, and so he begrudgingly took this acting class, and then, you know, found out about this audition, and his mom had to bribe him with some meal to go and audition. He didn't even want to do that, you know?
Can you tell us something about your parents?
Yeah, my parents, my dad roofed houses when I was young.
Because one of your main characters learns to be a roofer and then bonds with one of the people teaching him how.
Right, and I'd never seen that on TV, you know, or movies, something that took place on a roof like that. And like, it was such a part of my uncles were roofers. My dad also taught martial arts since I was five.
Did you learn how to fight?
I did. I was a competitive fighter growing up from the age of four. I think there's video of my first fight. My dad still teaches martial arts to this day in rural Oklahoma. And my mom worked for the tribe when I was young, for the Seminole Nation, and then worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. When she worked, she was a secretary for the chief of the Seminole Nation when I was young. You know, now what she does with the Bureau of Indian Affairs is she kind of oversees, like, there was so much, like, crookedness done towards Native people and land ownership and mineral right ownership. Mm-hmm. There's all of this record and things that have gone on since then. And my mom works in helping people kind of trying to figure out if there's land that they own that they didn't know they owned or mineral rights.
Is she still alive?
She is.
She must be so proud of you.
Oh, man. My parents are so overjoyed about the show. My dad said something to me the other day after the first season came out. And I was like, I can't, you know, it doesn't matter that we didn't get nominated for an Emmy. It doesn't matter that, like, what critic likes it or whatever. But, you know, what does matter? My dad, I mean, it does matter if we have critics like us, obviously. But, like, what I'm trying to say is, you know, this beats all of that. My dad one day said to me, he said, you know, you gave Native people a reason to hold their head up. He's like, this show has given people, Native people, a reason to hold their head up a little higher. And I mean, like, you know, to hear my dad say that is like, that's better than any Emmy that I could get. And just to also see the amount of people that love this show, especially in my community, because that's who I made it for. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm glad everyone loves it, but I made it for my community, Native people. And, you know, every year at Halloween, there's people that dress up in these like fake dime store Indian clothing, and they are quote unquote Indian for Halloween. And we've all seen that growing up. We've all seen it. And my kids are going to have to see it. But all of a sudden, after season one, people, kids started dressing up as the reservation dogs. So many pictures flooded in on social media of them dressed as the reservation dogs.
It's something you didn't have when you were growing up.
Right, I didn't have that, you know. And it might have made some sort of difference if I had. I didn't have that, you know. But I did. What I did have was the best storytellers in the world sitting in my grandma's kitchen telling me stories about these amazing characters that were real and or not. And I just try to transfer that to this show and to all my work.
Sterling Harjo, it's really just been great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
For this interview. Thank you for the series. I really love it. And I hope there's a season three.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Sterling Harjo, co-creator and showrunner, as well as writer and director of the FX series Reservation Dogs. This interview was recorded last year before the writers and actors strike. Season 3 is currently streaming on Hulu. After the break, we remember filmmaker William Friedkin, who's best known for films like The French Connection and The Exorcist. I'm Tanya Mosley, and this is Fresh Air.
I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.
The day's top headlines, local stories from your community, your next podcast binge listen. You can have it all in one place, your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
I'm Fresh Air's Anne-Marie Baldonado, back in your feeds with a reminder about our Fresh Air Plus bonus episodes. Hip-hop music just turned 50, and to celebrate, we're listening back to Terry's interview with Grandmaster Flash.
You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to hear that again, but this time, keep your microphone on and have you describe what you're doing as we listen to it.
If you want to hear what that sounds like for yourself, subscribe to Fresh Air Plus at plus.npr.org.
William Friedkin, the Oscar-winning director who thrilled audiences with the harrowing car chase scene in The French Connection and then terrified them in The Exorcist, died on August 7th at the age of 87. Though he made other films, none matched the impact of those two. The French Connection, made in 1971, was a gritty police drama and starred a then-unknown Gene Hackman as New York police detective Popeye Doyle on the trail of a heroin shipment. Here he is raiding a corner bar.
All right, come over here. You and you. Hey, Whiskers! Come on, man. Move ass when I call you.
Get in.
You! Come on, you, Baldy. Come on. Come on, move. All right, put it on the bar.
Come on.
Get it on the bar.
Get the hell in there. Put your hands on your head.
All of it. Smart ass, you drop something. Pick it up. Want the hand broken? Get it up there.
Hackman received an Academy Award for Best Actor. The film also won for Best Picture, and Friedkin won for Best Director. 2 years later, Friedkin returned with the film The Exorcist, about demonic possession, based on the best-selling novel by William Peter Blatty. Linda Blair played 12-year-old Reagan. Here she is being visited by a psychiatrist.
Are you comfortable, Reagan?
Yes.
How old are you?
12.
Is there someone inside you?
Sometimes.
Who is it?
I don't know.
Is it Captain Howdy?
I don't know.
If I ask him to tell me, will you let him answer?
No.
Why not?
I'm afraid.
If he talks to me, I think he'll leave you. Do you want him to leave you?
Yes.
I'm speaking to the person inside of Reagan now. If you are there, you too are hypnotized and must answer all my questions. Come forward and answer me now.
The Exorcist is one of Hollywood's top-grossing films to date and was the first horror film to be nominated for a Best Picture Oscar. Friedkin's other films include The Night They Raided Minsky's, The Boys in the Band, and Cruising. We're going to listen back to William Friedkin's Fresh Air interview from 1988, recorded with WHYY's Marty Moss Cohen. She asked him what he found so interesting about the criminal world.
My uncle was a famous police officer in Chicago. My uncle was the man who brought in Frank Nitti, actually captured Frank Nitti. And it turned out, while I was growing up and listening to stories about my uncle, at a certain point, the rest of the family learned that my uncle was actually on the take. He was actually being paid by Frank Nitti while he was a Chicago policeman. And after my uncle brought Frank Nitti in, he was taken off the Chicago Police Department and made a bodyguard. He was made the bodyguard to Frank Cermak, who was the mayor of Chicago in the early 30s. And he was with Mayor Cermak in Florida when an anarchist named Gus Zangara stood up at the Democratic Convention and took a shot at Franklin Roosevelt, who was being nominated, and missed Roosevelt but killed Mayor Cermak. And that was sort of the end of my uncle's career as a bodyguard. But all the time that I was growing up, I used to meet a lot of his cronies and a lot of the people on the other side of the law. My uncle owned a tavern after he retired from the police department and the bodyguard business. And I used to hang around that tavern when I was a kid and picked up a lot of stories and I guess a lot of impressions.
You describe him as both a fascinating and a frightening man for you. And I know for young children that there are often people in their lives who make this great impression on them. And it's an impression that they really carry with them for the rest of their lives.
Exactly. That is my strongest memory. Of youth, hanging around my uncle's tavern and listening to stories about the old Chicago Police Department. Then he had this extraordinary apartment, you know, with major appliances and stuff, which was way beyond the reach of the rest of the family. We were all very poor growing up there. My mother and father, may they rest in peace, they were Russian immigrants. Mm. And the rest of the family, as I say, was not doing that well. But my Uncle Harry was a champ, you know. So I was fascinated by his world and the contradictions in it.
Well, I know in your characters that they're, whether they're good guys or bad guys, that they're ambiguous characters and they're many shades of gray. And I'm wondering whether you think there's something about the criminal world that blurs that distinction between what is good or who is good and who is evil. Because I think certainly cops and criminals share the same world. They understand each other very well.
Exactly. Some of the most interesting, fascinating people that I've ever known are on the other side of the law. They're frankly on the other side of the law. And yet, if you didn't know that, if I were to introduce them to you or to any member of my family, they would be very charming. Very good with children, very vulnerable and emotional, and yet there is that other side. That has sort of been the theme of most of the films I've made, the thin line between the policeman and the criminal.
You grew up in Chicago, as you said, and you grew up in, I imagine, a kind of poor neighborhood, perhaps even a tough neighborhood. Were you a street kid? Were you a tough kid?
I don't think I was a tough kid, no. I mean, I would like to, carry along that sense of bravado. I was fascinated by what went on. I was pretty much on the fringes of most of the of the activity, although I was probably slated for trouble if it wasn't destroying my mother so much, and if I hadn't noticed what my own behavior was doing, I probably would be in jail right now. A lot of my friends were. But I never had the soul of a tough guy, frankly. Without much education, I guess, had aspirations towards something else. For a long time, I wanted to play basketball, and did. Played street basketball, but I tried to avoid getting into fights and all that. You know, a lot of it was inevitable.
Well,
and I certainly had a few, but I, by no means, was a tough guy or a gang member or anything like that.
My guest is Academy Award-winning film director William Friedkin. I think you make movies for men, and I think that the women who go to your movies are brought by their men friends or their husbands.
Mm-hmm.
And that you make movies, first of all, I think that the central characters are usually two men pitted against each other in one way or another. And they have the things that I think men are most interested in, which is car chases and action and a little sex and murder and fights and violence.
Well, you know, I guess that's a pretty accurate description of them. It's not conscious. I sort of get interested in stories like that, although I've done a wide variety of films. I haven't made that many. I think I've made 9 or 10 films, but among them is The Night They Raided Minsky's.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first film I made was a little piece with Sonny and Cher called Good Times. It was the first film that Sonny and Cher made. And then... But I guess you're right. The films I'm known for could be said to be described the way that you've described them. Believe me, it isn't conscious. I'm not more interested in men. And the kind of things that people tend to ask me to direct or are willing to direct when I say I'd like to make a film tend to be the kind of films that you've described. They're not necessarily the kind of films that I go to or that I prefer.
Film director William Friedkin speaking with Fresh Air contributor Marty Moss Cohen in 1988. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
On NPR's Throughline.
We cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get back to our 1988 interview with film director William Friedkin, best known for his films The French Connection and The Exorcist. He died earlier this month. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Marty Moss Cohen.
Well, one thing that you are known for are your chase sequences, and certainly in The French Connection, that I would think unparalleled ride of terror that you filmed is really, I don't think anyone has quite surpassed that. And I'd be interested in knowing how you set that scene up, how you played that scene.
Well, you know, they're very hard to do. It's among the hardest things to film, to first of all do something different, second, be able to realize it, because they're so very difficult to film without getting somebody injured, And third, to get an idea that is completely different from any other chase, because there's so many being done now.
That's right.
The French Connection chase, though, grew out of the character, the principal nature of the Gene Hackman character, Popeye Doyle, his obsessiveness. And I was very conscious at the time I set that chase up, because I really didn't have an idea for it until about 2 weeks before the film started. I was aware of the chase in Bullet that had preceded French Connection by a few years. I felt that I had to do something better than Bullet if I was going to do something in that vein at all. So in looking at Bullet, I could see certain flaws in it. I could see, for example, that they cleared the streets every time they made a shot. The streets of San Francisco were basically used as you would use a soundstage or a movie set. They were totally free of any outside, no other people on the streets, just the principals. So I thought, well, this would be one very good thing, is to have innocent people around, to have this chase going on in the middle of the day, in the middle of New York. In this case, it was Brooklyn or the Coney Island, a lot of it, and then various parts of Queens were cut in. But I thought, have people on the streets, have life going on, innocent bystanders, and work the chase into that so that there is a danger taking place to just these innocent people. Then I thought, you know, I could never top the movement of the two cars in Bullet. So I have to get something else. What is intrinsic to Manhattan? What is intrinsic to this neighborhood? What can I work into this thing that will vary this from one car chasing another? And I used to ride the subways, and still do in New York. And it occurred to me, yes, let's have a car chasing a train. Then I had to go out and find out how fast a train could go at its fastest if it, let's say, had been commandeered, as we portrayed it. And I found out that at its fastest speed, the train could only go 50 miles an hour. So this made it then theoretically possible for a car starting several blocks behind to catch up with a train. Then everything was very meticulously choreographed. I rehearsed everything before I shot it. But then accidents happened. Certain things went wrong.
There was a real accident.
Nobody got hurt. But things did not go as I planned them 100%. But I was able to keep the accidents, in other words, keep the mistakes. And I think it's the mistakes in it, the rough edges, that really make it. Also, the use of sound, Marty. That chase, I always let people come in and look at my dailies with me, you know, the rushes. I don't mind people seeing rushes and stuff. And nobody was very impressed with the rushes of that chase. If you had just seen it before it was edited, and then before the sound went in, you wouldn't have expected it to become, a great scene. It really is the juxtaposition of sound and the dynamic use of sound that's as powerful as the images.
The French Connection got 5 Academy Awards, including for Best Director, Best Picture, Best Actor. Do you think it's your best film?
No. I think the filmmaking in The Exorcist is better. A film I made that did not do very well is actually, I think, is the most important film I've made, and that's Deal of the Century, which was roundly roasted by most of the critics. But I thought it was important and funny. I don't think it's fully realized. You know, I don't think it's perfect, and I don't think it's as well directed as it could be, because the script was brilliant. The script was just first rate, and I don't think I did as good with it as I might have. It wasn't intentional, but I think it's still a very important film, an important comedy about the arms race.
Well, you describe The Exorcist as a film about the mystery of faith and no more, and I would say that people going to see the movie The Exorcist would say it's a horror film. And
I never thought of it as a horror film. Still don't. I don't think it... in any way fits into the category. First of all, The Exorcist was about an actual event. The actual event briefly took place in Washington, or in the Silver Spring, Maryland area in 1949. It was widely reported in the Washington Post then, and it involved a 14-year-old boy who was not from a Catholic family, but had these strange things happening to him, and was very, very sick and not diagnosable in any medical sense. And so through a series of circumstances, his family took him to the Alexian Brothers Hospital in St. Louis, where an exorcism was performed on this young man. And I was able to see the diaries of not only the priests involved in that exorcism, but the doctors and nurses who were in attendance. And they're quite stunning, quite eye-opening. They're in the archives at Georgetown, and I had access to them. And I realized when I saw these documents that this story had resonance way, way beyond anything like a horror story or just a work of fiction. It had implications that were far deeper and greater. And I tried to make the film with those implications in mind. There are no like crude effects in it. I specifically attempted to take those out. It's not a Hammer film of an Edgar Allan Poe piece or something. It also, The Exorcist is a very well-written piece. I think it stands up.
See, I think it is both what you say and also what the audience says, because I think in certain ways it describes the horror the doubt casts on our faith, and that it is about good and evil, which I think are elements that you play with, and that the horror has to do with a world that perhaps we don't understand, or a world where evil and goodness are in battle, and that we're in somehow peril because of that.
Oh, yes. But, I mean, it isn't about some monster stalking the streets with a knife. You know, it's not a slasher movie.
No.
It's not a vampire film. It's not a, it doesn't fit into any of the categories of horror pictures. It is like a realistic film about inexplicable things. Now, I know it's called a horror film. I mean, and it's won awards from horror film festivals and stuff like that. But it isn't that I don't like horror films either, but that mantle does not wear well to either Bill Blatty, who wrote it, or to me. We had far more serious things in mind. But it was meant to be a film that would be seen by a lot of people. You know, I've seen equally powerful films that dealt with, you know, the mystery of faith and the inexplicable that no one ever saw, like Carl Dreyer's Vampire or Debt, which is one of the greatest films I've ever seen, you know, about literal resurrection.
Well, I regret to say that we're out of time, and I thank you very much, William Friedkin, for talking with us this afternoon.
It was a pleasure, Marty. Thank you.
Oscar-winning director William Friedkin recorded in 1988. He died August 7th at the age of 87. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Marty Moss Cohen. Coming up, Justin Chang reviews the new indie film comedy, The Adults. This is Fresh Air.
Why is everyone so obsessed with traditional wives or trad wives on social media? This week, we're talking about the viral videos of women making marshmallows and mozzarella from scratch, and how behind the sheen of calm kitchens and cute fits, there's some interesting pessimism about our modern world. And that's worth digging into. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election: guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
Summer is for going to the movie theater because it's too hot to stay home. It's for driving with the windows down, listening to your favorite music. It's for stretching out while you're on vacation to gobble up a TV show. For a guide to some of the TV, movies, and music we are most excited about this summer, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
In the new indie comedy, The Adults, Michael Cera plays a guy who returns home to see his two sisters after 3 years apart. It was written and directed by Dustin Guy DeFay, who also cast Cera in his 2017 ensemble film, Person to Person. The Adults is in theaters this week, and our film critic Justin Chang has this review.
Michael Cera has been doing a lot of TV lately, but it's nice to see him back on the big screen for the first time in 5 years. You might have seen him steal a few scenes in Barbie as Alan, the discontinued Mattel doll briefly introduced in the 1960s as Ken's best friend. Cera's always been good playing oddballs and misfits, to the point of being typecast. And sure enough, he plays another one in his new comedy, The Adults. But his character, Eric, is one of his more interesting roles. He's tricky and temperamental and hard to figure out. And so are his two sisters, Rachel and Maggie, whom he comes home to visit. It's never explained why Eric has been away from his East Coast hometown for 3 years. Maybe it was COVID lockdown, maybe something else. But things are clearly awkward between him and his older sister, Rachel, played with a wonderfully sardonic edge by Hannah Gross. She lives in and takes care of the home they all grew up in as kids. Their parents are both dead. In this scene, Rachel gives Eric a frosty reception.
So how was your flight? Did you watch any in-flight entertainment?
They didn't have any movies on the plane.
Oh, bummer.
You look good. When did you dye your hair?
A year ago.
Oh, okay. I didn't really know that.
Well, you would have if we'd ever Skyped or FaceTimed or whatever. I dyed it the day after Rosie died.
Oh, good old Rosie. So it was like a symbolic thing?
No, just did it. Didn't think it meant anything. I think I just needed something to do that day.
No, I just meant, you know, it could easily be construed as a symbolic gesture. You know, it's mourning or whatever. Mm.
Rosie was their mom's dog, by the way. In time, we'll also meet the youngest and gentlest of the three siblings, Maggie, played by Sophia Lillis. Unlike Rachel, Maggie is delighted to see their brother back in town. But she's upset that Eric is only here for a short trip, mainly to see his old friends, and plans to spend just a little time with his sisters. He's even rented a hotel room, rather than staying at the house. The writer-director Dustin Guy DeFay doesn't overload his characters with backstory, but he subtly suggests that all three of these siblings are, in their own ways, feeling stunted and unfulfilled. The details dribble out gradually. Rachel works at a local radio station, editing what she contemptuously calls puff pieces. Maggie is a recent college dropout. And as for Eric, it's not entirely clear what he does for a living, if anything. He makes a big deal about having to get home, but he winds up easily extending his trip, not to spend more time with his sisters, although he does, but to join his friends' nightly poker games. Poker serves as a pretty good metaphor in The Adults, which is in some ways a movie about the art of the emotional bluff. It's about characters who keep hiding how they really feel behind a wall of snark and sarcasm. But there's more to their dynamic, too. As the story progresses, Rachel, Eric, and Maggie begin reverting to a form of highly elaborate and eccentric role play from their childhood, often involving singing and dancing. At times, their commitment to the bit is so extreme that you start to wonder if their parents were actors or improv comedians. The effect of all this self-involved play acting is by turns funny, bizarre, off-putting, and weirdly moving. After a while, you realize that it's only through this sophisticated yet childish language that the siblings can really connect and say what's on their mind. At the same time, some of their old gags and routines don't land the way they used to, which is poignant and relatable in itself. If you've ever had a relationship where it felt like stale inside jokes were all you had left, you might know the feeling. Through this role play, you come to see how these characters fit together. Rachel, the judgmental, responsible one, Eric, the prodigal brother, and Maggie, the fragile glue that holds them all together. There's a wide-eyed Peter Pan quality to Sophia Lillis' performance as Maggie, underlining our sense of these so-called adults as overgrown children. Michael Cera, with his gangly grace, makes Eric both infuriating and endearing. But the most memorable work here comes from Hannah Gross, whose mix of big sisterly fury and melancholy has stayed with me in the months since I first saw the movie. She turns this often squirmy comedy into something that might just break your heart.
Justin Chang is the film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed the new film, The Adults, starring Michael Cera. On Monday's show, we look at the misogyny and homophobia in hip-hop that marginalized artists who didn't fit the hyper-masculine image and how that's changed. It's girls and gays running things now, according to NPR Louder Than a Riot podcast host Sydney Matten. We'll talk with Matten and her co-host Rodney Carmichael. I hope you can join us. To keep up with what's on the show and to get highlights of our interviews, follow us on Instagram at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shorrock. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman, Julian Hertzfeld, and Charlie Kyer. For Terry Gross, I'm Tanya Mosley.
Jasmine Morris here from the StoryCorps podcast. Our latest season is called My Way. Stories of people who found a rhythm all their own and marched to it throughout their lives. Consequences and other people's opinions be damned. You won't believe the courage and audacity in these stories. Hear them on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR.
On Wildcard, the new podcast from NPR, you'll hear people like comedian Jenny Slate reflect on their lives. What is something you think about very differently today than you did 10 years ago?
Dressing, like not salad dressing. I've always loved it and I'll never stop. Dressing my body.
That's all part of the new game show Wildcard, only from NPR. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.